So we've been really focused on compliance this year, but then now when you're looking forward to financing transactions, you know, what do we need to be thinking about in this room in terms of reviewing models? How do we do our structures going forward? And one of the key elements of this, particularly in a partnership context, is where your debt sits in the structure, and it's in regarded entity structure, really matters. So if you have reserve-based lending, that's usually going to be right next to the assets in the same legal entity. If that legal entity is a separate partnership or regarded tax entity, then all of your ATI limitations and your business interest expense limitations will be applied at that level. So if you have any other sources of income that are flowing in higher up in a tiered partnership structure, you're not going to be able to aggregate all that ATI to come up with a more of an aggregate solution for your limitation. It'll just be trapped at the partnership level. And so that can create a big headache and really this negative arbitrage on an exit. The other consideration that we've talked about is that effectively when you're doing cash flow models, you've got to consider not only the fact that 163J is out there, but you've got in a corporate setting your limitation on your NOLs. So two things that I've seen in financial models on valuation allowance analysis, if you combine your 163J limitations and your NOL limitations under the new rules with the 20% haircut and P&A obligations, you play that out if you forecast your taxable temporary differences, and you can end up with needing more valuation allowance than you can support with your reversal of DD&A, which is usually a really positive source of income. So you really got to be careful in valuation allowance analysis, and then you also have to be real cautious about your cash flow analysis. Because in E&P world, usually if you follow kind of pure cash flow analysis, you can determine when your cash taxes are going to hit. And that's just not the case anymore with all these interactive limitations. And then one final point on that, when you're evaluating when you're going to take bonus depreciation or make 59E elections is a totally different game now. Mm-hmm. So in a corporate context, most of my E&P clients, we really managed our deductions, right? Because bonus was great, but we had AMT. So you could end up with cash taxes if you didn't smooth out your income. And so your triggers for that were bonus depreciation, but then you have to be cognizant of how that impacts your Texas margins tax and 59E. And those are the levers you use to manage the timing of your deductions and your taxable income. Now it's a much harder determination because if you do 59E elections and you elect bonus depreciation or elect out of bonus depreciation, what you can do is have a permanent impact on your ATI, because if the DAW is not saved in 2020, you're no longer going to be able to add back that depreciation. So 7-year asset for lease and well equipment, that last couple of years of that depreciation will not be added back to ATI. So it could have a permanent impact on your ability to deduct interest. And one final, I mean, this is a matter Greg and I were discussing before, that something that we never really cared about that much. But when you deal with guaranteed payments, the proposed regulations sort of identify guaranteed payments as sort of, for the use of capital, as sort of an interest equivalent type item, and therefore subject to 163J. So that brings up a common sub K issue, is if you have preferred equity, which became pretty common after 2014, is that preferred equity that give rise to a guaranteed payment to the partner, or is that just an allocable item of partnership income? And I think the conservative answer for that is, you know, our sub K guys like to think is guaranteed payments need to be far away from net income. So if guaranteed payments paid regardless of your net income from the partnership, then it looks and smells like a guaranteed payment, and then you can fall into this rule, which obviously we'll see when we get final regs. If it's not, then it looks like an allocation of partnership income. So that's an issue that you really got to focus on in the context of 163J.
And the way I think of a guaranteed payment is the partner who's receiving the guaranteed payment, are the other partners essentially paying for that? Is it coming out of their capital, or are they getting less of a loss allocation if the entity is in a loss situation than they otherwise would? Is the partner, is it actually supported by income of the partner? And the simplest analogy I could sort of make is to a corporate preferred stock. I mean, if you're a preferred stockholder and the company has earnings and profits or makes money, has cash flow, you get a dividend. And if not, you wait. You're first in line. You're going to get paid before the common shareholders do, but otherwise you may not get paid. I think it's somewhat similar in the way I view preferred returns versus guaranteed payments. If it's a guaranteed payment, you get paid. You're supposed to get paid whether the company makes money or not. You know, they go to the bank and borrow it, or the partners take it out of their capital or whatever. Whereas a priority allocation is just that. We may not have enough money to pay everybody. I get paid first. Then you get what's left over.
Right, right. But these are big dollar amounts, so it's very unexpected if all of a sudden not only your debt, because you usually have both the preferred interest and debt, so the combination of those two could be a very significant add back for this limitation.